Warning, this episode contains brain food that will lead to improved emotional and social intelligence. Thanks for tuning in to Harvesting Happiness today for a healthy serving of consciously prepared brain food. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen, your host. For more than 13 years, I've been handcrafting these sound ideas for better well-being. Each week, I love spotlighting diverse thinkers and doers who are contemporary trendsetters and change agents, devoting their lives to creating a better world in which to live. I invite you to listen up and change the way you think about human happiness. Our award-winning content is fresh, optimistic, and purpose-driven media that promotes well-being from the inside out. Alrighty then, let's dive in. This episode offers psychosocial education designed to inspire and motivate our listeners. The information provided does not constitute a therapeutic relationship nor a substitute for professional mental health care. If you are experiencing a mental health crisis, call 911, go to your nearest emergency room, or for listeners in the United States, text 988 for the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. Thanks for joining me on today's show, where you will learn about cultural identity, healing, and belonging. My guests today are Soojin Lee and Linda Yoon. Soojin Lee is a licensed marriage and family therapist and executive director of the Yellow Chair Collective, as well as co-founder of Entwine Community. Linda Yoon is a licensed therapist and social worker who has dedicated her career to helping people along their healing journey, find a sense of belonging. And together, they have co-authored the book, Where I Belong, Healing Trauma and Embracing Asian American Identity. Welcome, ladies. I'm super excited that you're here.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for having us.
It is a pleasure. And why it's so much of a pleasure is that whenever I get the chance to interview people who have written books like you've written, there's a theme, right? The theme that we all want to belong, right? Regardless of where we come from or what our experiences are, the human drive to be connected is ubiquitous. Like everybody has it, no matter where we come from.
Yes. And I feel like in a way that this is the perfect time to talk about it, because in the midst of the pandemic and COVID, like we all felt such sense of isolation.
Yes.
And it felt like we were really displaced from that sense of belonging, even more so than ever.
Yeah. Let's talk about the importance of the premise behind Where I Belong, because I'm holding this book and I want to congratulate you, because I know giving birth to a book is a big deal. And you have written some very meaty material here, ladies.
Thank you. It definitely took us a while to get to this point of having this book in front of us, in front of the world. And we wanted to talk about the sense of belonging, right? We could coming back to this word. And the way that we derived this book was in the midst of COVID, in the midst of everything that was happening, all the violence that was taking place on the news over and over again, we were realizing that we needed to create a space of safety where we can all gather and talk about the experience that we were having. A lot of us were feeling confused and isolated, and we had nowhere to process these feelings. And so we started creating these online community spaces at the Yellow Chair Collective, and that experience informed us to make sure that it can become accessible, like the information and the processing and the stories that we were telling together and each other. We wanted it to become more accessible to everyone else that couldn't be present in that, in those online spaces. And so then it turned into a book in a way where the book reads exactly like that experience, as if you're sitting in a support group space where you're hearing other people's stories. There's plenty of like that first person point of view stories that are being told, and then we're unfolding those stories and explaining about the trauma that we collectively experienced together.
There was an added layer of trauma, I think, if I think about what went on during COVID for the Asian American community, because there was so much hatred that seem to have been focused over innocent people that had nothing to do with COVID, but yet the way it was portrayed in the media made it easy for the Asian American community to be a target. And I think that must have been horrible, because not only are you dealing with the trauma of COVID and the disconnection and the isolation, but also this other area of hatred that must have been very scary.
Yes, that was a scary time for a lot of us, and a lot of our clients, our communities really were suffering. But it was also a place that it really showed where Asian Americans, you know, Asians in America really belonged, right? A lot of times conversation around racism has been very, you know, within Black community, white community, very Black and white. And a lot of Asian people really didn't know where they belonged, because a lot of Asian people will say they have experienced racism, or they don't really know what racism looked like, because we don't really talk about having racism. We didn't really talk about racism against Asian people in modern days in America. So we really brought up like, hey, there is racism in America. There always has been for Asian Americans. It just has not been always had language to it, or it wasn't really out, you know, right in front of you. And that really, that was a time that really escalated that, hey, like we have issue a lot around belonging here, around Asian Americans.
And yet all of the different cultures, which people want to perceive perhaps as the minority, whether you're Asian, Black, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, from any other part of the world, these minority groups do make up the majority. You know, that's, I think, the interesting part of all this, that, you know, most of us are not 100% purebred of anything.
Right. And it was so complex when we started talking about like trying to define ourselves as like, who are we as Asians living in America? Who are we that we are identifying? Some of us are identifying as Asian Americans or as children of immigrants, or, you know, this just, or just even American sometimes, right? Like some people that we were speaking with and some of the people that we have the stories for, they don't even want to identify as Asian Americans. And so I think the topic of like, who lives here and how do we get along was a huge question that we were exploring together.
Let me ask you a question about therapy as being an accepted norm within the Asian culture, because I think for so many of the different cultures, talking about feelings is something that is very, very foreign, because so many groups have endured so many hardships, you know, over the years, that there was no talking about feelings. There was just the doing and getting through it.
Yes, for traditionally, and still is, Asians in America tend to be the racial group that seek mental health, professional help, the least likely to seek therapy, mental health services among any other racial groups in America. Some of that definitely go back to our culture. Like there wasn't really this thing called therapy when we were growing up in Asia. Very foreign concept. Like we talk about our feelings. It was a lot more about let's get through, you know, like there's a lot of hardship. Like a lot of Asian countries have gone through wars, a lot of tragedy. And also process of immigration can be very very tragic or very traumatic, you know, putting you to survival mode, right? Like when you're trying to survive and you're trying to feed your family, you're not going to sit down and think about your emotions. Yeah. You don't have time for that. You gotta live. You gotta feed yourself, feed your family. So there's a lot of that clients that we had who really struggle with what mental health, what's emotions. Can I feel that? That's not okay. We just gotta work hard. Definitely, we worked with a lot of older first-gen immigrants who have gone through a lot. A lot of wars, a lot of traumas, like there's no language, you know, because they never got to really learn that language, first of all, and that may not have been, or they couldn't because of survival. And that passes along to next generation times, yes. right? We don't know how to have language around your emotions. Like, you're not going to teach your kids how to have those languages, right? You might be dismissive about your child's emotions because you don't know how to deal with your own painful emotions. So yeah, that it has been a big conversation, and that has been something big and something that the community really mobilized during the anti-Asian hate crimes and pandemic, because our mental health, because the issue became so big and we had to talk about it. People are like, yeah. we have to do something about. So we saw significant increase of Asian American or Asians in America or all over the world, I heard, seeking mental health services for the first time. It was to the point that we were looking for like each other, like, oh, do you have any, you know, openings? Do you have any openings? Like, we had no Asian therapist who had opening.
Yeah.
at the peak of it. Yeah. So it was tough, but it was also kind of like, wow, like people are really, are coming together to have this conversation. People are seeking help because they're trying to make sense out of it now and heal.
And you spoke about intergenerational trauma, and I would love to go back to that, because no matter where we come from or what we identify as, this is a fact, right? That we sort of inherit these traumas that occurred long before we arrived on this earth. Mm-hmm. And in confronting that, compounded by the pandemic, compounded by racism, I can imagine that people are trying to figure out who they are. Like, where do they fit in the context of these three different stories, these other external stories?
Yeah, I think that's, like you mentioned, it's something that everyone relates to, right? There's something within the family. It almost feels like, in a way, Linda was talking about how there's this lack of language around emotions, but sometimes it's not even just emotions, right? Sometimes it's about the whole history of generations of the past that we are unaware of. There's gaps. And yeah. I like to describe them as like these ghosts in the family. Like,
yes.
I think so many of us can relate to that there's this ghost in the family and we don't really know. We just know that it exists, but we don't know in what form it looks like or how they came to an existence into our family. And no one talks about the ghost. And it could be something that is a traumatic or a story that exists in our family, or it could be an actual person that we just neglect to speak about because they have done something wrong or shameful, quote unquote, and they have been dismissed in one way or another. Or it might even just be things that are of survival, right? And that through different immigrations and migration stories that we've just lost part of ourselves. I mean, just no longer speak to those parts of our families anymore.
What a beautiful opportunity, though, to go there. Right? Like, you've created a safe environment for people to dive in. And I think that's the beauty of the work and why this work is so important.
Because one of the things that we find to be so beautiful and painful at the same time is the discovering of that ghost, as I said, and seeing the strength behind everything that we have gone through as well. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book as well, is like we process and try to learn of all the things that we suffer through, and we come to a realization. And at the end, that right alongside all of those struggles and pain points, and that there was strength that had kept us alive and continues to make us thrive.
Yeah. The resilience is astounding. And the resilience is the secret sauce, right? That carries us through these difficulties. Let's take a pause. When we come back, we will continue the conversation with my guests today, Soo Jin Lee and Linda Yoon. They are the co-authors of Where I Belong, Healing Trauma and Embracing Asian American Identity. They're also the co-directors of the Yellow Chair Collective. You can learn more about them and their beautiful work at yellowchaircollective.com. On Facebook, you may find them at Yellow Chair Collective. And the same for Instagram at Yellow Chair Collective. Here comes the pause. We'll be right back. Research tells us that happiness is good for our health. Happy people live longer, are more productive, and make better partners, parents, and professionals. Want more sound ideas for better well-being? Check out our new bonus edition content, More Mental Fitness by Harvesting Happiness, available exclusively on Medium and Substack. One thing I know for certain, happiness waits for no one, and at times we all need a little support. To learn more about lifestyle management and mental fitness consulting services, please visit harvestinghappiness.com. And we're back, continuing the conversation with my guests today, Soo Jin Lee and Linda Yoon. We're talking about cultural identity, healing, and belonging. Let's get back to it. So ladies, I have so many questions because there's so much good material here. I want to talk about the Yellow Chair Collective, that asking you to explain a little bit about what it is. And I think we understand why you started it, but who you serve.
Yellow Chair Collective is a mental health organization based in Los Angeles, California. We provide therapy services in the state of California and New York, and we are also expanding. But our coaching and community groups are available in all states and beyond.
You know, it's kind of funny the way that we ended up becoming servicing all over the country and beyond, as Linda said, because, you know, as licensed clinicians, you'll know that typically for many licensed clinicians, they're really restricted to servicing just within the state, right? And that was definitely the case for us too. And then with the peak of the COVID that we just talked about and all the ways that mental health was just not accessible, and all of these cultural elements were popping up, people were looking for very specific types of people to serve them, right? Especially if they've shared the experience of being an immigrant or being a children of immigrant or being an Asian or, you know, any of the above, then, you know, they wanted to see a therapist that identified that same way so that they don't have to explain what was happening, yeah. Right? So then we realized that it was really important for us to try to expand our services beyond just the one-on-one therapy. And so the support groups and these community groups and workshops started happening. And because these were support groups and community groups, as well as, you know, the workshops, then we were able to have all of these people that were already reaching out to us for help from other states. Sometimes, you know, there were people that were saying, you know, I live in the Midwest and in this small town, I'm the only person in my town that looks like me. And I want a therapist that looks like me. How am I going to find that? Right.
In the middle of
wherever.
They,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we said, it's really important that we gather these people and saying, like, you're not alone. You're really not alone. Like, you're physically maybe alone in that space, but mentally and the experience in which that you grew up in, you're not alone in that.
Yeah.
And so these community spaces started happening in that way. And so then all of these people from all over the country were starting to attend our support groups and workshops. And then, to our surprise, people from like Europe, people from Australia were also contacting us and saying, what you're talking about, I identify with that. Yeah. I grew up in, you know, especially we were getting a lot of clients from Canada too, and saying, you know, I identify with the stories that you are telling and the work that you're doing. I might not exactly identify as an American. Some people are like, I hate that word, but, you know, like I identify with the fact that I don't have the sense of belonging, that I've lived through racism, and that I feel like I'm alone in this journey.
You talk quite a bit about intersectional identity, right? Which is really what you're mentioning. And I would love for you to expand on that for listeners to do the thought experiment for a moment, to close your eyes and put yourself in your shoes or of somebody else within the Asian American community who is grappling with these issues and then adding this other element of racism, which had not been an acknowledged issue until COVID.
The intersectional identity issues are one of the top things that people are inquiring our services for and what our gatherings and all of these community groups really support in discovering of and being able to talk about the intersectional identity issues. Imagine you said, let's do an experiment here. So then imagine you're growing up in a household that has never talked about emotions, never talked about mental health, and all of a sudden you're starting to feel depressed. You have no idea what it means and why you feel this way. You're just unable to get up in the morning. You're dragging through and you just feel this misery just hanging over you all day. You have no place to put that into words, that experience into words. You come home, you're still expected to perform. And that performance may look like if you're in school, to still keep up with your grades, to make sure that even though it is so hard to get up out of your bed, that you are still needing to get out of bed and you're still needing to get ready and be on time in school because all of your other siblings, all of your immigrant parents depend on you to get up and be in the car on time to make sure that everyone else is also taken care of, right? And on top of that, that for a lot of children of immigrants, you might already know this word, but be parentified, right? You're not only having to take care of yourself, but your perhaps non-English speaking parent is requesting that you read some of these letters that were sent by their, I don't know, government authorities, or even just at something
health insurance.
As simple as trying to, yeah, health insurances, you know, any of that sort, right? So these are some of the ways that, you know, a lot of Asian and Asian Americans or Asians living in America have experienced, and any children of immigrants have experienced what it means that we just have to grow up and we just have to live and survive and to take care of not only ourselves and neglect the ways that we need emotional support, but be there physically to take care of the need of the family. And you're growing up in a household that says that that need, that family's needs, is more important above anything else.
Oof, that's intense.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. And there's no space for the soul at that time, right?
Right.
I would say it goes in a way, parents a lot. Suja and I just had this conversation how a lot of immigrant parents, many of the stories we heard, they decide to move to America or leave their country sometimes because they feel like there's not enough opportunity for their kids, or they just want a better life for their kids. So traditionally, parents give up everything in their home country and come to America for their kids. Everything goes around their kids, you know, kid doing well in school, you know, getting a good job. And there's this sense of just taking care of each other in a lot of Asian countries that is expected, which has its beauty, you know, being able to have intergenerational household that take care of each other, but which also put a lot of pressure, right? And the children of immigrants, a lot of time, we see our parents' sacrifices, you know, what they gave up for them, right? So the pressure goes kind of both ways in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would think because of the intergenerational nature of Asian families, that the children will look after the family elders until they die, right? I can imagine that part of the struggle, internal struggle, is like, who am I in the context of this, right? That I'm born into a prescripted destiny to be, right, to be the provider and caretaker for my parents, which I think is, like you said, it's a beautiful system because it is integrated and it provides wraparound care for the family unit. But and the other side of that is it fills the space where the individual lives.
Right.
Internally.
Yeah. And I think part of the struggle, like the part of the bigger struggle with that is the fact that they have been now separated from the entirety of the culture and system in which that was acceptable.
Yeah.
So everyone is expected to take care of each other and everyone supports each other in being able to do that. And in a way, in a lot of Asian countries, that the system itself, whether that's like healthcare system or senior housing system or however it is that they're built to do that, whereas they move here and they still carry that expectations and pressures where the system goes against it.
Yeah. It's a individualized, right? The autonomy, the me generation, and then like there's no space for the me generation in the family system within the Asian culture, not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the book addresses really finding like how do we navigate this, you know, living two worlds or two cultures, right? Or identity, you feel like who you are at your American school or American workplace, and at home with your, you know, immigrant parents who expect you to carry the values of the culture and family, right? So like, how do you navigate? And, you know, it looks different for everybody, how to find, you know, balance, right? There's no perfect balance, but like, you know, what sits well with you? Because Sujin and I, both of us, like we really resonate with like, yeah, like we had to navigate growing up with my parents' expectation of being this good Korean daughter, older daughter too. We're both older daughter. So we have to take care of our little siblings and be a role model. But also like, hey, like I see, you know, what my other classmates, you know, or other colleagues are able to live, right? More pursue their dreams, be more independent. Like, how do we balance that? Because they're both important to us. And then we also want to honor our family, but also honor our new identity we are kind of folding as well while we're navigating it.
You know, I'm wondering if in a certain sense, by creating the Yellow Chair Collective and writing this book, that you're not creating a greater, extended, unlimited family, you know, that sort of the cultural responsibility is just a bigger net has been cast. And I find that beautiful.
Thank you. I think you've put it beautifully. Like our whole mission and goal is to bring people together and that we are able to create our own community that supports our own identities and the ways that we're struggling and to find healing together in it, right? Yeah. This community that we're trying to build, we also understand that we have to work through those intergenerational traumas and find very creative ways to find intergenerational healing. The one-on-one therapy work sometimes can be very, very difficult because
I can imagine.
Yeah, separates the one person that is sitting in front of us that is trying to deal with all the elements, the external elements of the family's expectations, pressures, and all of it, right? And the way that they're carrying the identity. And it's really beautiful work to be able to do that and go through that journey of the internal language. And then what do? When things are not changing in the family though, right?
Yeah.
Is we have to know how to navigate the family system together. And to do that, we have to meet with other families, right?
And perhaps create a family of choice that then becomes the scaffolding network that supports you in dealing with your family of origin, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You need
both
exactly. In order to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We are out of time. And I can't thank you enough for sharing part of your day with me. I think the work is so beautiful and the stories that you've written about so compelling that one does not need to be Asian to relate to the human condition, you know, that we have all navigated in one way or another. So thank you for being here. I want to give our listeners, you can go to the yellowchaircollective.com. Once again, yellowchaircollective.com to learn more about the work of Sujin Lee and Linda Yoon. They are the co-directors and the co-authors of Where I Belong, Healing Trauma and Embracing Asian American Identity.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for joining us on Harvesting Happiness today. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen on behalf of my guests, Soojin Lee and Linda Yoon, wishing you kind thoughts, kinder words, and the kindest of actions. Until next time, remember, happiness is an inside job. Happiness is your inside job. Please go out and rock your day and remember to be kind to one another. Want to take a deeper dive into sound ideas for better well-being? Check out our new bonus edition content, More Mental Fitness by Harvesting Happiness, available exclusively on Medium and Substack. Keep harvesting your own happiness anytime, anywhere, from the comfort of wherever you are. Subscribe, listen, and share hundreds of downloadable episodes from wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with and follow us on most social media channels. To learn more about lifestyle management and mental fitness consulting services, please visit harvestinghappiness.com. Harvesting Happiness and More Mental Fitness are produced by me, Lisa Cypress-Kamen, Andrea Mengele, Robin Boyd, Andrea Daly, and the awesome team at Podfly Productions, including Eric Begay, Kimberly Beck, and Alec Guess, in collaboration with TogiNet Radio, KBUU, RadioMalibu.net, and is available on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.